In the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 15 and verse 15, it says that if we're found false witnesses of God because we have testified of God that he raised up Christ, whom he did not raise up, if in fact the dead do not rise, for if the dead do not rise, then Christ is not risen. And if Christ is not risen, your faith is futile and you are still in your sins. And then he goes on in verse 19 to say, if in this life we only have hope in Christ, we are of all men most to be pitied. Now, in a conversation about the resurrection, there is nothing more important for the Christian faith. In fact, its founders made it the issue, the hill on which we are to die on. And if we're going to be able to discuss anything with people, obviously, discussions about the afterlife should begin there. Has anyone been there? Can we confirm and trust that person to give us a reliable report? And in fact, that's how we do all of history. We need to answer two questions. Were people there to see it? And can we trust them? In fact, the word history comes from the Greek word histor, which means to carefully analyze and interview something to find out whether it is true. We'd call it eyewitness today, an eyewitness testimony. And it would be a good thing to remind all of you that before I give this report, this does not come from the genius that would be held within this mind. I take no credit for this in any way whatsoever. What we're going to discuss here tonight on this commemorative holiday, the day that we celebrate our liberty from someone's country, we would be able to also celebrate our freedom from death because someone demonstrated once and for all that through him it could be done. And here's the interesting part about all of this. The two people that we're going to be citing, technically three, but two mainly, are going to be first, Dr. Gary Hammerbass. Now, for those of you who've seen the Case for Christ movie, he was one of the first people that the author of that book and the main character in that movie, Lee Strobel, interviewed, who was the leading expert on the resurrection in the world and still is to this day. Likewise, we're also going to be using the material of Nabil Qureshi. Nabil was a former Muslim who, after investigating the evidence of the Christian faith, and remember, as a Muslim, the main difference, the main claim between us and Muhammad's word is that Muhammad claimed Jesus was not crucified, so obviously he couldn't have risen from the dead. It all stands or falls on this. So what I want to do here today with all 21 of you, is to discuss that topic, the resurrection, something that is so important, something that is so meaningful that it didn't just rock the foundations of history, but also is literally life and death for us as Christians. If we don't have anything else to share, if there's nothing else that we could explain at a scholarly level with people, everything else is secondary. This is what's most important. This is where our freedom comes from, that Jesus demonstrated firsthand in a moment a verifiable history that he rose from the dead. And on that rule said, this would be the proof that I am who I said I am. So let's get started on that. How do we prove that Jesus rose from the dead? How do we prove a resurrection at all? Well, in order to prove that, we basically just need to know two things. One, that Jesus died, and secondly, that he was seen alive again later, both on a historical basis. Now, the average internet atheist is going to say, well, how do you know Jesus existed in the first place? Well, that first point clears that up, because it's hard to die if you were never born. We're going to basically prove those two things, but for the sake of these kind of questions, you run into the Jesus mither. In the scholarly level, that's about as informed as being a Holocaust denier. But on the other hand, if you run into your average atheist on the street that doesn't know a lot about these sort of things, you may run into that. So let's start with the utmost basics. How do we know, and remember that word histor again, we need people to have seen it, and we need reason to trust them. And it's actually bonus points if you can find people who didn't even like that person, acknowledging the things that they did. Anyone can say one thing about themselves, but if you have two people saying the same thing, two separate people, perhaps two different minded people, both acknowledging the same fact, that's how you could know something is historical. A minimum of two ancient sources, doesn't matter how far apart or how long after the main event. And I know this is very riveting information, especially after a barbecue dinner, but I promise to match your excitement if you'll join with me in this. When we're talking about the resurrection, we need to be able to know that people saw this, and that even people who wouldn't have made it up, perhaps even people that didn't even like the individual being talked about, someone who didn't even believe in who they were, if they acknowledged their existence And if we have at least the bare minimum facts to prove two things, that Jesus was dead and he was alive again later, then our faith is based on fact and not feelings. Well, Jesus' existence is pretty straightforward. If we were to prove the existence of anyone in history, we need sources, and we need to hopefully have them within the lifetime, or at least close to those events. Now, how many of you guys know who Alexander the Great is? Historical figure, something plain enough? Yeah, a few of you. Well, Alexander the Great, for those of you who don't know, he conquered the entire known world at the time, from Greece all the way to India. Now, that's a big accomplishment, especially in the short amount of time he did it. I asked my junior hires this. They're able to tell me, oh, yeah, he was privately tutored by Aristotle. Junior hires knew this. I was impressed. They had a rope where the person who could untie it was destined to conquer the world, and no one told him he couldn't cut it, so he cut it. Private stories like that. Who raised him? Who was his father? What his mother was doing in her free time? All of these things that even I didn't want to know. We were given all these sort of details about Alexander the Great's life, and do you know when he passed from the world scene? It was around 320 BC. 320 years before Jesus came on the world scene. Now think about this for a second when you realize what is the earliest source that we have. And I don't mean like just an inscription in a rock or like a passing mention of him. I mean a whole complete text. Well, the first source we have on the Alexander the Great account is Plutarch in his Life of Alexander. Now Plutarch was around in the late 1st century AD. And the total number of complete accounts we have, at least as far as the earliest are concerned, would be a grand total of 5. That would be in the order Plutarch, Arrian, Diotrus, Curtius, and Justin. 3 Greeks, 2 Romans, all acknowledging the same figure. How many do we need in order to know something's historical gold? 2. So, plenty of reason to believe this, even though the earliest isn't written until 400 years after his death. Happily teach that in schools. Another example is a name you're probably even more familiar with, Julius Caesar. He was not the first Roman emperor, but almost became the inheritor of that title. A dictator, the Roman Senate, Shakespeare wrote a play dramatizing his betrayal, Et tu, Brute, all these interesting things. Well, we have even less as far as historical accounts about him. He was around a little bit before Jesus' life, almost 100 years. And Gaius Tranquillus' Life of the 12 Caesars was written 300 years after his death. And likewise, the grand total only adds up to 4, Gaius, Plutarch, Crispus, and Titus. Now, we'll go more into this in a moment. I'm not just giving this information to wow you. I'm not even taking credit for it. But when you compare these historical figures that we cannot deny existed, that we have every reason to believe were real people, compare that the first almost Roman emperor, a man who conquered the entire known world in record time, compared to a Jewish carpenter. How much evidence do you think we have for Jesus' existence? Well, for Alexander the Great, we have 5 total. For Julius Caesar, we have 4. But because they're within a few centuries of the originals, let's compare that to Jesus. The first biography written of Jesus' life, and this is according to skeptics, to the atheists, to the people who have a bone to pick, according to the historical evidence, if we're going to be objective, and happily ask us about this on our radio program, A Reason for Hope, 1-877-556-1212, Monday through Friday, 5 to 6 p.m., 106.7 FM on your home radio. But the reason why they would date Mark to the first is really, really stupid. And I'd love to tell you about it, but we don't have time. I just spent the last minute harping about it. The gospel according to Mark is the earliest they would date. And that takes place roughly around 10 years after his life. Now think about that for a second. The earliest biographical source we have on the life of Jesus within 10 years, according to atheists. And compare that to Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar, who we don't get anything written on until at least 300 years after their lives. And the total number of accounts, that's a lot of names. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, I'm sure you're all familiar with. The Apostle Peter, technically cited as the source for the Gospel of Mark.
Paul, in his letters, acknowledged Jesus' existence. James, his biological brother and one of his apostles. Jude, short for Judas, he was one of the apostles. Polycarp, who was a disciple of the apostle John. Eusebius, Quadranus, Ariston, Clement, Ignatius. All of those people, by the way, early church fathers, people who were followers themselves of the original eyewitnesses, who would be in that two-generation gap. Likewise, once we reach Thallus, that guy wasn't even Jewish. He was a Samaritan follower of Jesus, and we'll talk more about him in a moment. This is going to be fun. But then we get to Josephus. Now, for those of you who know a little bit about church cross-reference history, you know Josephus wasn't Christian. He was a Jewish Roman historian. He was one of the people that were captured when Titus took over the area of Judea, when they burned the temple to the ground and such, and he surrendered. He was one of the few Jews in their garrison that weren't willing to kill themselves as opposed to being subject to Roman authorities. Josephus was just like, I prefer life, and he said, fine, I'll write books for you. That's great. Josephus acknowledged Jesus' existence, and that's all we need. Likewise, Tacitus, who was a Roman and he hated Christians, admitted that Jesus was the starter of a disgusting cause in Judea that had the unfortunate, by the province of the gods, and unfortunately the Roman emperor is trying to deal with this, but the unfortunate just malady of infecting Roman culture. He acknowledged Jesus was a real person. Likewise, the Talmud, the writings of the Pharisees, they acknowledge him. Marabon Seraphon, who was a Greek, Suetonius, Pliny, Thallus, Phlegon, Celsus, Pilate, in a letter to the emperor Tiberius reporting his execution and why suddenly it's gotten a little bit unruly. Origen, Gaius, Lucian, the Gnostic texts, people who were misrepresenting Jesus still present him as a historical figure. It goes on above 40. How many did we have of Alexander the Great again? We have over 8 times the amount of evidence for a Jewish carpenter's existence historically, but you can't teach this in schools. So if anyone's going to be objective, and most even atheist scholars are willing to do at least this, denying Jesus' existence is not even in the ballpark if you're going to do honest history. Even if I throw out all of the Christians, the people who'd want to believe at this, do you think that we would apply that same rule? We'll be happy to listen to American history, but only by the people who hated America. Great, but even then, we have at least 3 times as much as anything. I'm not making you my punching bag, Dave. It's just ironic. You see the point that I'm making here. When we're talking about the evidence for Jesus' existence, it's undeniable even by atheist standards. So let's get into the real questions here. If Jesus was a historical figure, was he dead? Well, you can ask the eyewitnesses who saw his crucifixion, and from the reports themselves, we can say that Matthew, because he wrote an eyewitness account recording it, was able to see the event take place from a distance. Likewise, Mark's gospel records it. Luke also includes that in his gospel account. But when we're talking about the execution of Jesus, Peter, John, Mary, his biological mother, Mary Magdalene, who is one of his followers and later a disciple, Thomas, apparently, knew about the fact that Jesus was stabbed with a spear to confirm his death, the third stage of a Roman crucifixion, a death blow. He was aware of this and said, unless I put my hand in his side, I won't believe. He was aware of the fatal wounds on Jesus and the fact that he was dead. So we have Thomas, we have Matthew, we have John, we have Peter. How many do we need to confirm something historically again? Was that more or less than the fingers I was holding up before, and this is just for the Christians? You think that maybe we have people who aren't even Christians that acknowledge this is a historical fact? Don't answer. I'll do it for you. The gospel accounts, if we count them as one, Polycarp, Clement, and Ignatius, and the others all reported that Jesus was crucified by the Romans, but we also have hostile reports. People who didn't believe in Jesus' message acknowledge his historical death, one of the 2 things we need to prove to ensure his death and resurrection are historical facts. Now note, if we allow the Christian sources, can we prove this historically? Absolutely. We need a minimum of 2 separate accounts reporting the same thing. What if we only allow, as some of the ardent skeptics in our world today will only listen to? What about the people who didn't believe in Jesus? The free thinkers, the open-minders, the smart people, right? Well, they don't help you. Because firstly, among the people who weren't there, I mentioned Thallus. Thallus, yes, he was a Christian, so I guess the atheists wouldn't want to hear from him. But this is the fun part, and why I was starting to grin a little bit when we mentioned his name. Thallus was not a Jew. He wasn't even an eyewitness. He was a later convert to Christianity, and he was a Samaritan. Now, he reported in his writings that Jerusalem went dark during Jesus' crucifixion. Same thing that Matthew reports when it was in reference to Joel. God's wrath was being poured out on him, correct? Now, think about this for a second. What if I told you that we have none of Thallus' writings? No record of them historically, no museums, no diggings. We have nothing on Thallus. Why am I then telling you about him? Because someone who tried to correct his claim ended up doing us two favors. We know about Thallus because of a man named Julius Africanus. And for those of you who don't know, that's Latin, so he was Roman. Julius Africanus, in his Book of History, Volume 3, said that Thallus was incorrect in stating that it was a supernatural darkness. It was a solar eclipse. Now, for those of you who know, Jesus was crucified on Passover, which was determined by the first full moon of the Jewish New Year. Now, I don't mean to brush you up on your astrology here, but understand, when we have a full moon, where's the sun? Directly behind us, directly in front of us, or at a 90-degree angle? How can you have a solar eclipse when the sun is here, the moon is here, in order to shine a full moon on the planet's surface? Do you see what I'm talking about here? Not only did he get his astrology mixed up, but he just confirmed to us another eyewitness. And he's not even believing in this stuff. He badly tried to debunk a miracle report and ended up proving it because, A, he acknowledged that it went dark. That's all we needed. Secondly, that it went dark when Jesus was being crucified, but said, no, that was a solar eclipse. And we look at our astronomy charts and go, wait a minute. Dang it, you just admitted something to us that we needed and also made yourself look foolish. Well, why should we listen to him then if he got his facts wrong? Okay, let's move on. Let's start with Tacitus then, who was a Roman. And by the way, I made no small efforts to clarify to you, he hated Christians. And yet, in his book, The Annals of Roman History, book 15, chapter 44, he reported that Jesus was executed as a criminal during the reign of Emperor Tiberius. We have set a date. In fact, it's on Thallus' reports that we could assume that either Jesus was crucified in 30 AD or 33 AD, because non-Christian sources verify an event that took place during a life of someone we know in history existed, even by their own standards. So think about this. They're giving us little bits of information that we're using to literally build the machine that's going to end up knocking them out at the end. So think about this. Tacitus hated Christians but admits that Jesus was executed. What do we need for a resurrection? He needs to die first. Thank you, Mr. Tacitus. Third, the Talmud, the writings of the Pharisees, specifically Talmud Sanhedrin 67, the beginning of the verse anyway, reported that Jesus was executed by the Romans. Now, you'd think they'd be bragging about that a little bit. Why? Because they caused it. You think they'd be fans of him suddenly? Well, one of them was. We'll get to him in a moment. But actually, two, if you count the other guy. But anyway, Josephus IV, in his Historical Antiquities of the Jews, reported Jesus was executed during the governorship of Pontius Pilate. Again, verifying another historical figure we need. Remember, we need a minimum of two people. Based on non-Christian sources alone, we have double. Even if we dismiss every single Christian account, we can conclude the bare-bones first fact we need to know Jesus died and rose again. We know he died. Why? Because even non-Christians during his time were willing to admit it as history. But it only gets better from there, because that's ancient history. They didn't have the technology we have today. What about the people in modern scholarship? What about really smart people in colleges and, you know, those university professors that convinced me that Jesus was just, you know, he was maybe a good moral teacher, but, you know, totally talked me out of all of this religious nonsense and got me into free thinking so that I could date whoever I want and so forth. Well, they don't help you either. We have not one, not two, but three listed for you here today, and we'll happily provide more. Atheist, non-Christian scholars in today's world that would say the following about Jesus' death, something we need in order to prove he rose from the dead. First quote is from James D.G. Dunn, who, by the way, for those of you listening at home, is a New Testament scholar from England, but he would be about as Christian as Anton LaVey, if you understand the point I'm making here. He studies the New Testament not because he believes it, but because he just considers it a worthwhile life's pursuit. And the interesting thing about him is that he was one of the members of that Jesus seminar. I don't know if you guys remember that. Back about 15, 20 years ago, a bunch of scholars that would be so far on the left of the spectrum, they were about to fall off. I mean, they make the social justice warriors today look like centrists, okay? And they wouldn't believe a phone book if it included a citation to a local church. That's how skeptical they were. And yet one of their chief guys was willing to admit, and I quote, and we'll quote him again here in a moment, that the crucifixion, in reference to the quote, is the two facts of the life of Jesus that command almost universal assent. Of the two things that everyone should agree with, according to an atheist, that his death is one of them. Likewise, John Dominic Crossan, who is also an atheist and another member of the Jesus Seminar, said that Jesus' death by crucifixion under Pontius Pilate is as sure as anything historical ever can be. Now remember what I said at the beginning of this. It's very hard to die if you never existed. These people are probably more skeptical, more atheistic, and more qualified to say some things about him. They not only acknowledge that he existed, but that he died, which is one of the two things that we need to prove in order for Christianity to be based on fact. Thank you, Dr. Dunn. And then lastly, if you're on the internet, you're going to hear this name a lot, Bart Ehrman, who is more famous in talking out of both sides of his mouth on a scholarly reference, but because his name comes a lot, I'll include his reference and quotes in this as well. Bart Ehrman stated, "The crucifixion of Jesus by the Romans is one of the most secure facts that we have about his life." So not only acknowledging that he existed, but that he died, and it's hard to rise from the dead if you haven't been dead yet. What have we proven? What are the historical facts? One, that Jesus existed. You can't die if you were never born. Secondly, Jesus died. That is acknowledged by both Christians and non-Christians, people who were there and didn't like Jesus, and even people today who have all of our technology and the modernistic philosophies and perspectives are still willing to acknowledge this as fact. And more specifically, that Jesus died by Roman crucifixion. I don't have time to get into it here, but if you have seen The Case for Christ, it was briefly mentioned, illustrations from it. The little, very small booklet, in fact, I'd rarely even consider it a booklet. It's more like a tract, and you can read it on PDF online. Look up On the Physical Death of Jesus by William D. Edwards. That's On the Physical Death of Jesus by William D. Edwards, where as a medical professional, he analyzes what crucifixion would do to the human body. And if that's what Jesus went through, he wasn't just dead. He was really dead. So moving on from that point, if Jesus died, what is the second point that we need to prove in order to know whether or not Jesus rose from the dead? He needed to die, and he needed to be seen again after. What is the historical method? We need at least two separate sources that both say the same thing about a specific event. If they're both trustworthy, then we can conclude anything historical, as long as you have two separate sources that can be tested and trusted to have that report. Now, the eyewitnesses for Jesus' resurrection would be who you'd expect. Jesus' early followers first had the opportunity to see him as Mary Magdalene, Mary, Joanna, and Salome, referenced in the Gospels of Luke and Mark. Other women who were also cited but not named. After that, Peter saw Jesus risen from the dead individually. James, likewise, his biological brother. John, the apostle. Thomas, the surviving apostles together in a group. And over 500 disciples, notice there's a difference between disciple and apostle, the 12 apostles, the disciples, were just people who followed him, and that was a large number. 500 disciples at one time, and we have their encounters with him recorded in Matthew 28, Mark 16, Luke 24, John 20, and Acts chapter 1. Now, think about this for a moment. Where did I get that information? Because for those of you who have read the Gospels, you know that these encounters, yes, some of them were in groups, but fairly sporadic, where do you get the number 500 at one time? Well, this is actually where it gets really juicy historically, because even according to our most helpful atheist scholars, they would actually date a Christian writing before the book of Mark, which, remember, 10 years after Jesus' life, correct? Now, it's hard to remember things 10 years in the past. I mean, if I were to ask, hopefully, some of you married couples, what was your wedding day like? Well, you'd be able to remember that because it was an emotionally impactful event. Hanging out with God for 3 years, I'm sure some of it would stick. Not the whole 3.5 years for sure, but definitely enough to make a little papyri roll, if I'm making my point clear. Well, when we're talking about this idea that Jesus died, he rose from the dead, and that this proved a point, there was a writing, a collection of just this small little poem. And remember, a lot of the early Christians couldn't read, so they wouldn't benefit as much from a scroll as we would today. In fact, the early church was the first one to utilize the technology of codices, the little leaflet books that we use everywhere today. They would be able to learn about Christian things by hearing about them, but how would they be able to take things home and memorize them? I doubt if I asked you guys on your way out here today to recite to me back this message, I wouldn't be insulted if you couldn't do it. This is a lot of information. But do you think that if I were to ask you your favorite song lyrics, could you recite that from memory? Perhaps even the worship songs that Dave sung for us, would you be able to recall those words? Well, absolutely. It's not hard to catch those sort of things. If I have a tune in my head, if I can remember it, and especially if it's short, simple, to the point, perhaps even in an organized manner so I can recall the tone before even the words itself, that's going to help. Well, one of the earliest Christian creeds, they called them, these small little sections of doctrine that would be what the early church memorized to know what they believed and why, is recorded for us in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 through 8. Now, I want you all to read this with me because this is something that for atheists or even Christians themselves, this is the biggest historical account that we have in the entire Bible, including the entire Old Testament. For I delivered to you, Paul speaking, of that which I also received. Now, think about that for a second. Paul received this. Is he the one making it up? He got this from someone before him. Catch that because it's important. That Christ died for our sins, first fact, according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day, according to the Scriptures. Then he was seen by Cephas, a nickname for Peter, then by the 12 groups. After that, he was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to the present, but some have fallen asleep. Meaning that some of them have died, but most of them, at the time of this writing, by the way, 1 Corinthians 50 AD, 20 years after Jesus' death, some of them have died, but you could talk to a lot of these people still here today. After that, he was seen by James. We'll get to that in a moment. Then by all the apostles. Then last of all, he was seen by me as one born out of due time. Now think about this. When was this written? In the 50s, right? 1 Corinthians was written at that time. So before 50 AD, Jesus had this idea passed among his followers that he died, that he rose from the dead. Two things that make or break Christianity. So within this 20-year mark, Paul received this information. Well, understand, the reason why we call this stuff historical gold, and this is very important for you to track with here. When we talk about this creed, 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 7, 8 was included by Paul to explain he saw him later. This was something that was passed around the early church at a very early date. Sooner than 10 years, sooner than 5 years. In fact, according to atheist scholars, I'll quote once again Dr. James Dunn, that this tradition, we can be entirely confident, understand this, was formulated as tradition within months of Jesus' death. Now, a lot of you aren't appreciating the dates here. He said months. That can't be more than 2 years. And when we think about this for a second, let's do a little biblical history here. In Galatians chapter 1, verse 15, Paul recalls his conversion very briefly before he starts ripping into the Galatian churches for missing the whole point of Christianity. And he says, "But when it pleased God, who separated me from my mother's womb and called me through his grace to reveal his son in me when I became a Christian, that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not immediately confer with flesh and blood. I didn't automatically go to these people, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me. But I went to Arabia and returned again to Damascus, then after 3 years." Remember that. Paul spent 3 years in the desert by, well, we can add that later when we go through Acts. What he was doing, well, think about it. How many years did the apostles spend with Jesus in his earthly ministry? Three. How many years did Paul spend by himself? Just a thought. But let's focus on the atheist perspective here. Then he went up to Jerusalem to see Peter, the original eyewitness, and remained with him for 15 days. I don't think they were just playing Fortnite together in the basement. "But I saw none of the other apostles except James, the Lord's brother." There's a thought. "Now concerning the things which I write to you indeed before God, I do not lie. Afterward, I went to the regions of Syria and Cilicia, and I was unknown by face to the churches of Judea, which were in Christ. But they were hearing only he who formerly persecuted us," remember that, "he who formerly persecuted us now preaches the faith which he once tried to destroy, and they glorified God in me." Chapter 2, after 14 years, remember that, "I went up to Jerusalem with Barnabas and also took Titus with me. And I went up by revelation and communicated with them the gospel." Who were them? Verse 9, Peter, James, and John. Catch that. "And then I went up by revelation, communicating with them, which I preach among the Gentiles, privately to those who are of reputation, lest by any means I might run or had run in vain." Now think about this. Paul is being careful. He spent 3 years by himself clarifying what he was going to tell people about Jesus. And then, after those 3.5 years, he went to Peter to check these things out, and for over 2 weeks was asking them questions, saying, "Is this what you saw when Jesus rose from the dead? Or did I just not drink enough water that day? In the Syrian desert, who knows?" But think about this too. After 14 years, he went back again to Jerusalem to confirm with those three eyewitnesses everything that he did. And in verse 6, it points out, "They added nothing." This is when we can assume that Paul received that creed, because the church would have been going for some time after 16 years. Now think about this for a second. When did Jesus die historically? I want you to understand this. Let's say, you know, got big ostrich legs here. When we got a nice big long step, let's call that 10 years, okay? If we have this event, Jesus' death, 30 AD, we would then have Pentecost, 50 days later, the founding of the early church, the rising up of Stephen, Philip, and the other five deacons. After that, Stephen was stoned. Maybe after a year of preaching, maybe sooner. We haven't even scooched yet. Stephen is founded. The church is living together. The church has been established in the thousands in Jerusalem. Stephen is martyred at this point. We haven't even reached the full 10 years. Remember that. Stephen is martyred, and a mass persecution breaks out. Christians flee for their lives, knowing that they could get killed for their faith now, and a man named Saul volunteers to hunt them down and bring them back for execution, for daring to say these things about Hashem, the name, what Jews call God, not daring to utter his name, YHVH, Yahweh. Now think about this. Within that point, Paul is persecuting Christians, maybe for a few weeks, maybe for a few years. We don't know. Let's assume 2 years. Haven't taken that full step yet. we're right in this region within 5 years of Jesus' crucifixion, if we're generous, Paul heads to Syria, and on the road to Damascus, he encounters Jesus. 3 years later, finally that full 10 years, he spent in Arabia and confirms with the original eyewitnesses. 14 years later, he verifies it with them again. And then 1 Corinthians, reminding them of what he first received. And when was that? Right here. Now, for those of you who aren't appreciating this, recognize, what did we talk about with Alexander the Great, that he took his events that he reported in his life, right? Conquering the known world, all the things he did, 320 BC. We don't have the earliest report. Let's be generous. Let's say a full step is 10 years. Alexander the Great's death, going to Plutarch, 50, 100, 150, 200, 250, 300. Oh, by the way, did I mention this is when we think he wrote? I can see some of you getting nervous, and you should, because this is gonna where it gets funny. Do you know when the earliest written copy of Plutarch was found? 350, 400, 450, 500, 550, 600, 650, 700, 750, 800, 850, 900. And we can't teach that in school. Oh, but this, oh, more than happy to deny this is just biased information. Meanwhile, let's tell kids about that. Junior hires can tell me about that. So, months within Jesus' death, and they acknowledged those two things, that he died and that he rose again. Now, understand this. The Christian reports also are very telling, because understand, who are the first eyewitnesses of Jesus' resurrection? The guys? No, it was the girls. The first people to see Jesus risen from the dead were women. If they were making this up, do you have the slightest idea of how chauvinistic and sexist the first century Jewish traditions were? Let me give you a hint. In the same book written by the Pharisees, the Talmud Sanhedrin, there's a quote that says, "We would rather burn the law than let it be handled by a woman." The Pharisees even began their prayers in the morning, saying, "Oh, Lord of heaven, thank you that I was not born a slave, a Gentile, or a woman." And if these Jews who were raised in that sort of culture were making this up, do you think the first thing they would say is, "The women believed before I did"? This isn't acknowledging an eyewitness. This is going as far as to saying, I'm embarrassed to admit this. And historians love that. Why? Because if you admit to a fact that makes you look like the idiot, you didn't make it up. Frank Turek had a great joke about this. He's another apologist. He said, if the apostles were making this up, this is how the Gospels would have gone. Peter, James, and John would have marched right up to that tomb, roundhouse kicked all of the Roman elite guards, and then John would have thrown them out by their little leather skirts and said, "Get out." And then Peter looked him in the eye and said, "I'll be back." And then Jesus came out of the tomb and said, "Well done, men, on your great faith." No, what happened? The women were the first one to see the tomb. Peter and the apostles saw him later, but they didn't believe when they saw the empty tomb. And even then, when Jesus in Acts chapter 1 was standing in front of them, ready to be raised into heaven, having appeared to them multiple times, some were still doubting. They had seen how brutal a death Jesus died, and they're just like, "I still can't believe this." You think you'd be making that up if you were trying to start a fake religion? Likewise, not just the women, not just the apostles, not just groups of disciples, but like Jesus' death, it's even better. We get bonus points, right? If the people who didn't want it to be true admitted it. Of which, by the way, how many do we need to have a historical fact? We have that many hostile reports of Jesus' resurrection. The first, Saul of Tarsus, a man who murdered Christians, admitted to seeing him alive again on the road to Damascus. The second one is even funnier. James ben Yosef. Those of you who don't know who that is, James, son of Joseph, Jesus, his biological little brother. Remember, Mary and Joseph had a normal family after Jesus was born. Joseph did not know her. Kids, ask your parents what that means at home. Until Jesus was born. What happened afterwards? The average Jewish family, anywhere from 3 to 5 kids, were given the names of Jesus' 3 younger brothers and sisters, whose names we don't have. But James, who was the leader of the early church at the time, admitted that he thought his brother was beside himself, literally talking to himself. They thought he was crazy and didn't believe him until after he saw him risen. Now, for those of you who have an older sibling, sympathize with me here. What would it take for your big brother, who was always perfect, literally in this case, that he was God? I think a resurrection would be a start, wouldn't you? And so when we're talking about this, we have 2 hostile reports. His brother thought he was insane, and a guy who was so dedicated to wiping him out that, oh my gosh, just overnight he decided to abandon his career, abandon his family, abandon the culture of which he was raised, taught under the known, like, worldwide scholar of Judaism at that time, Gamaliel. This guy threw it all away to embrace this kind of life. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 24 through 27. From the Jews, 5 times, I received 40 stripes minus 1. You guys remember Passion of the Christ, the scourging scene? Imagine that without the other 2 phases that many times. 3 times, I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned with rocks, not weed. 3 times, I was shipwrecked. A night and a day, I have been in the deep, floating on the ocean. In journeys, often in perils of waters, perils of robbers, my own countrymen, Gentiles, the city, wilderness and the sea, false brethren, in weariness and in toil and sleeplessness, often in hunger and thirst, in fastings, often in cold. They had a lot to gain from this. And no, that's Paul. That's one of the hostile reports. We don't even have to get into what the original eyewitnesses went through. Down to a man, with the exception of John, they all died for their belief. It's one thing to die for something you have been convinced of falsely. Muslims do it every day. On the other hand, it's another thing to die for something you made up. You don't die for your lie. Now think about this for a second. Give me one person in history who died for something they knew was false. Oh, we just so happened to get all of them in Christianity? So understand this. Here's the historical facts. Individuals and groups saw Jesus crucified. Friends and foes of Jesus claimed to encounter him, not see him fleetingly, to eat with him, to touch him, to speak with him in groups. They all didn't have their own experiences. And these witnesses all endured lives of persecution, torture, and death for sharing this with people. Remember that rule. We need people who have seen it and reason to trust them. If these men went to their deaths, it proves they believed it. And if they're the ones who started it, that is an eyewitness testimony. So here's the conclusion that we could make from all this. Atheists and Christians alike both affirm the evidence that historically we can verify the only things we need to know in order to prove Jesus rose from the dead. It's not a matter of evidence. It's a decision with what you decide to do with the evidence. Christianity falls or stands on one claim, a claim that we can historically verify. Your move, Pilgrim. Dad, thank you so much that you've given us so much to base our relationship with you on, knowing that it all stands on the one thing you made sure that even stubborn little animals like us couldn't get wrong. You made your death public. You demonstrated your love in a way that no one could deny. And now it's ultimately a matter of accepting that gift personally and knowing not just that you died, knowing not only that you rose from the dead, but why you did it for us, that you valued us that much when we were at our worst, that you were willing to demonstrate your love so much that you didn't just prove who you were, but how you felt about us. I pray that each and every one of us here would not only thank you for that, but be assured of that as a fact, that we would know and test ourselves to know that our relationship with you is based on facts, not on feelings. Dad, we thank you for those feelings when they come, but we're even more grateful that this is reality. And I just pray that that's what would ultimately be shared. Strengthen your people and encourage them to know that their relationship with you is a fact of history, and that they can enjoy you emotionally because of those things and not the other way around. And as we have the opportunity to share this with people this week, that you would use those seeds, that foundation in your word that you placed, that even atheists can't help but bear witness to in history. Thank you so much for all that you've done for us. We praise you for who you are, and we thank you in the name of your Son, the one who demonstrated that love to us personally. Amen.